Blog Talk Radio.
What's happening, everybody? It is that time again when we are live, this time on the right time that you're looking for, the Wednesday evening at the 8 o'clock hour, because you know there's so much going on that we had to talk about. I am the person that is known as the Sun, and my mother, Citizen Payne. My mother is on assignment as usual in heaven. This is the Kate Thompson Live Show. Me, your host, Citizen Payne, the co-host, Brother Byron Saunders and Brother Wayne Gilman. And as everybody knows, you know, we have lost one of the, probably one of, well, not probably, one of the greatest basketball players of all time. And Kobe Bryant and his daughter, as by now the world, if you don't know, you should, you probably have heard that he was killed in a tragic helicopter accident on Sunday, early Sunday, in Los Angeles, Calabasas, when the helicopter hit the side of a hill in thick fog and things. So by now, everybody kind of knows a lot of those details. I was, to be honest, I was never really a Kobe fan. I thought he was kind of a ball hog type of guy that liked to shoot a lot. But when you're that good, that's the type of person you're going to be. But I was I'm a basketball head, so any basketball head recognizes the greatness of someone like Kobe. And you know, to be great, you got to be a little selfish. You know, it happens in all great individuals, driven individuals, in anything across the board. When you meet someone, hear about someone who's great, who's put that time in, there's a certain amount of selfishness. There's a certain amount of selfishness that I have, performers have, people wanting to go for their dreams no matter what. And so you understand that about Kobe. Also, too, if you're that good and you feel you could make every shot, why not? Basketball being a smaller team sport, you know, it's a group of individuals, but they make up a team, but it's easy. You rely on each individual when it comes their time to do their part. And in scoring, and the name of the game is a score. And who else did it better? Very few people did it better than Kobe, and did it better than rising his team up. If you watched the last game that he ever played in his life that they rebroadcast the other night, it's remarkable that that was a final retirement game. You know, I had forgotten that he started 0-6 with the game, didn't score his first couple of points until the end of the first quarter. But he scored 15 points like that fast, and then it was on. And the whole time the Lakers were trailing, because Kobe was really like the only good player on the team. But he brought them back. Not only did he score 60 points, he brought his team back to win. And then he retired, and Mamba was out. And what a way to go off. My connection, the interesting thing about that, and I'm going to bring Brother Byron in here in a minute, I just wanted to say the interesting thing about Kobe is when I first moved to Los Angeles in 1996, Kobe Bryant was just joining the team. He had been traded for from the Charlotte Hornets to make the trade to come to the Lakers. And so I've been a Laker fan, but I go back to like Magic and those guys, my era, a little bit older than the Kobe and Jordan fans even. And so, you know, but my homeboy, Shaquille O'Neal, the Big Diesel, being a Newark, one of Newark's finest from Newark, played for the Lakers, so obviously I'm going to root for them. So the kid comes in calling the kid Kobe Bryant, but that's when he started out. So basically my point is that I was out there living in L.A. during Kobe's heyday and got to see him a lot on TV, obviously, and went to a couple of games to watch him do his thing. Went to two finals games when the Nets came and made it to the finals with Jason Kidd, thanks to my cousin. We went to see that game, third row under the basket near the Lakers bench, was great. And then again, we went to see the Lakers play in the finals of game one with the 76ers, where Allen Iverson dropped 40 on them and they took that first game, but of course they didn't win. And same seats, sitting over there close to where he stepped over Tyronn Lue and all that stuff. And also saw the Lakers in playoff games, Western Conference playoff games, to go to the finals and things like that. I guess one of the early years that Kobe was playing, Rick Fox, Robert Horry, and a lot of those guys were on the team at that time. So, you know, I got the opportunity to see Kobe live in his heyday at the height of his career, as well as living out in L.A., just, you know, Kobe mania, you know. So I just wanted to say that, and it's a very tragic thing. I'm going to bring the brothers in to see how they feel, get their comments in, and then we'll get to this impeachment trial. Let me bring in Brother Byron Saunders. Brother Byron, how are you this evening?
Well, like yourself, my brother, grace and peace to all who are listening and, you know, our nation and the world went through a shock of all things. And it's kind of interesting that the timing of the shock, right at a time when you're getting caught up in a world of virtual reality, lies and theft and cheat and killing and all kinds of perversions just going on, and you wonder, where is the real world? You know, in the real world where death defines the of our human existence. You know, we got people running around thinking they're kings and gods and what have you. And yes, the shock of it is, it happened to a brilliant young man, 41 years old, still very young. Career with many, many ups and downs. But look what the work that he continued to do and the lives that he's touched. And I find it interesting that you say timing is everything. There are no accidents, Eric. As this particular moment, as tragic as it may be, it's like a slap in the world's face to say, wake up. Wake up to the reality of things that are, not things that people pretend that they should be. Because there's some stuff that's going on where challenge and truth is being challenged. What is the truth there? I mean, you know, what Kobe was the truth. And you see the reasons why. Because he touched the world. So, having said that, here we are back in the cesspool of Washington, D.C. Oh, my God. Every hour on.
You're really breaking up. You totally dropped out now, Byron. Hello? Hello?
Yeah.
Okay, you came back.
Yeah.
Good. Gotcha. You're back now.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, here we are in D.C., Eric, and we kind of said this has happened. There will be breaks for those who want truth. And the truth is what justice is all about. That's why Kobe's tragic passing and his daughter, Gigi, and the other individuals. This is a wake-up call. This is a very serious wake-up call. Life is serious. And the stuff that's going on in the Senate is not a game show. See, a lot of people are so hooked into virtual reality world and Housewives of Atlanta and the Potomac,
mm-hmm.
and Chicago. And you know what I'm saying? And it comes back to what is real.
Right, right. What is important. Let's bring Brother Wayne in. Before we continue on, I know he wants to get in here too, and his commentary is always insightful and welcome. Brother Wayne Gilman, legendary newsman. How you doing, Wayne?
I guess all right. I'm feeling the vibe, man. You know, it's just a very sobering moment. When I heard the news, I was outside an Italian deli up here in Westchester where I get some fresh produce, and I was standing in line. This white guy who was in back of me had his phone. He was looking at his phone. I normally leave my phone in the car. And I guess the first announcement came over the phone, and he looked at me and he said, "I can't believe it." And I said, "You're kidding me. I can't." You know, I was so dumbfounded by, you know, what by the news that he had passed. And the guy turned around and told me, he said, "Doesn't matter how much money you make, you know, doesn't, you know, it's about wanting to embrace your family, your friends, and put pettiness aside, because we don't know when is going to be our last time." And there was just something very, very strange about the day, because no sooner, and this is just an aside as I walked out the deli to go back to my car, my cousin called me from the coast, and I thought she was calling me to talk about Kobe, and it turned out her father died. So I had to deal with, you know, it was just like one thing after. It was just something very surreal and strange about the day. Even the weather, you know, was supposed to be bright and sunny up here in New York. And it was very overcast, but, I mean, you know, a loss is a loss regardless. And I just feel so badly for his wife, you know. I didn't know him personally, and I'm of the generation of Michael Jordan and the trash talking and, you know, this little upstart 18-year-old from Philly, you know, suddenly blows up in the NBA and, you know, obviously copied a lot of moves from Michael, but also extracted moves from all the seasoned players of that particular day. And he was brilliant. And even though I didn't know him, I did have one connection with him. And it was a regrettable situation back in 2003, 2004 when he was brought up on charges for alleged rape in Colorado. And I got into a verbal back and forth with Bill O'Reilly, who was at the Fox television network at the time, you know, in the freaking spin zone, as he called it. Excuse my language. But just conjuring thoughts about that just bothered me because he couldn't understand why I would come to this man's defense based predicated on stuff he was saying. But, I mean, it's just sad when you see somebody do so much in such a short space of time. And some of the interviews that I saw on TV, and I don't want to belabor the point and sound, just overwhelmed with it, but the deal is that I think he had an inkling that his life would be short, you know? All of us walk with an expiration date, and all of us from time to time come in close contact with facing one's mortality. I certainly did last year, and as I look back at time, you know, I still miss your mom, you know, conversations we've had, things that we've gone through. I mean, it's just life is just so fragile.
It is indeed.
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Finish your point.
No, I was just going to say the fragility of life, man. It just sobers me up. So, you know, when I was listening to Byron just a moment ago, the deal is we're really living in some very, very perilous times. And we just have to embrace those moments that, you know, that we support one another, you know. And I mean, I don't know what's going on with the Republican Party, but I hope they come to their senses too. But, you know, to me, the Kobe death overshadows the crap that's going on now. And it's like a circus when I tune in to watch.
Right. For me, like I said, I wasn't a huge Kobe fan, and I actually worked on but I respected his ability as a ball player. And certainly, of course, obviously you have to be a fan of his ability. And just watching some old clips of his that they've been playing, you forgot just how bad he was. I mean, Kobe was
right.
The truth, you know what I mean? So without a doubt, and that was his destiny, obviously, to be that good and to be that exceptional, being that his father was a professional player, being that he was brought up in Europe. He brought a different kind of swagger when he finally moved to Philly. You know, he was a dude who was multilingual. And I was having a straight basketball discussion with my nephews the other night. And I think that the fundamentals that they talk about Kobe being so sound in probably were learned, obviously, from his father first, clearly, and then in Europe, which is they emphasize the fundamentals as they do here. But I don't think the swagger of the street game is the same as it is in the United States, of course. So I think he probably...
Mm-hmm.
On top of that natural ability, the fundamentals, the swagger once he came to the United States and moved and started getting his street game together, and also his work ethic. I mean, you know, I had heard that Kobe was serious about his thing, but who knew that this guy was so great, but worked like he wasn't that as great as he was. He didn't take his God-given talent, and he says this in interviews, he didn't take his God-given talent for granted, and he wanted to use every bit of it, use it all up. For me, the passing of him didn't strike me. You know, we always get, society gets collectively because people, celebrities pass, so we all know them. And so I like how they all stressed the passing of the other people on the plane as well, because sometimes the average person gets looked over, you know. I couldn't get that bit out of shape. I was disappointed. I was sad, for Kobe and his family, certainly. I've heard how a mother responds when they lose a child, so I'm very sad for his wife and certainly for his daughters. But I just came from a funeral the day before. My partner from Drop Squad Pictures, his father passed away. So,
right.
You know, and this is someone I know, so I couldn't get that broken up over a celebrity that I think I might have seen Kobe in passing. Maybe we might have said hello to each other, what's up. For some reason, that image is in my mind, and I might have just been around when he was around, and he was just nodding at everybody. But, you know, I couldn't get that up for him. You know, I mean, it wasn't striking me as some other people that I was – with at the time, and they were really bent out of shape about it. But you understand his effect, and the point I want to make about him being a little bit different. When he became a player, right, a professional player, and now he's influencing all of these young players to come up. But Kobe was intelligent. Kobe was multilingual. Kobe had a swagger, a different swagger than the brothers that might have come up differently in the United States. Hard, and maybe they didn't have the educational opportunities. Maybe they were, certainly a lot of them probably weren't multilingual. So Kobe set the bar to a new standard for these young cats to come up, like my nephew's age, who came up idolizing Kobe, who's at UVA now and played basketball, Seton Hall Prep, and all of their generation. He established a certain athlete scholarness. You know, and I think all those years ago, probably when he first came, or probably during the middle of his career, is when you started. If you guys remember, there started to be an emphasis on these brothers being scholars and athletes. And a lot of the guys, when you see football players and these young college players being interviewed, they were preparing themselves for careers after basketball, because you see how many of them want to be commentators, want to get jobs. So I think that Kobe Bryant helped to bring the level and the expectations of these young men, not just to be athletes, but to be Renaissance men, be intelligent, be smart, be interested about the world. And that's what I really appreciate about who he is, that he was able to do that for the next generation. And I met someone at one of the political boot camp I went to. And this woman, a number of speakers would come to speak to us. And she spoke about a term she called intergenerational mentoring, meaning that you can be mentored by someone younger than you. You can be inspired by someone younger than you. You can get advice and information by someone younger than you. And a lot of people were older than Kobe, a lot of older players, and you hear all these stories about how he affected people with his knowledge and some of the things that he believed about how to put your all into everything and make the most out of every opportunity. And that's something that can be applied to life, period. And so when you hear that about an individual who did so much with what he had, it inspires you not to waste much time. And me being one of the chief members of the Procrastinators Club, I've got to take that to heart. And also,
and I think we all are. To a certain extent, yeah. Not to cut you off, but you know, I as you mentioned that, Eric, I'm reminded of seeing LeBron James the night before break Kobe's record.
Right.
I was watching,
right.
Just happened to be channel surfing, saw the 76ers game against the Lakers, and of course the 76ers won. But earlier that night, they had a little cameo shot of Allen Iverson. And when I juxtapose the image of Allen Iverson, who at one time said, "Practice? What's that? What's practice?" You know, and here it is, Kobe, from a completely different perspective, was just focused on improving his game. You know,
yeah, and I think that I just want to say at that point, I think that Al's response was more into the way that they were trying to treat him as opposed to his mentality about playing. And, you know, the grief they would give Al. And that's a perfect example that you say that because Al is from – he's like the opposite of Kobe, right? He came up hard.
Right.
He came up not having the advantages that Kobe had. They tried to jam him when he was a young man in high school that an incident went down. If you've seen any documentaries about him, an incident happened at a bowling alley or somewhere in high school. Kids were fighting, and Allen Iverson was the only one name they knew because he was the most popular because he was a athletic star even in high school, and he ended up going to jail for that. So his mentality, which influenced a lot of young cats from a different perspective in a different way that Kobe did, he's kind of like the yin to Kobe's yang, right? You see the opportunities of someone who like Kobe who had those opportunities and someone like Al who didn't, and obviously how their lives turned out, unfortunately. The aspect of LeBron breaking his record the night before in Philadelphia, and I think that it's almost like a movie, right? Because wasn't it that Kobe – it was almost like 24 years or to the date or something. It's the same day that Kobe won his MVP trophy. And here LeBron breaks his on the same night and other circumstances that lined up. And that not only does he break his record, Kobe calls him, you know, and if you look at that interview that LeBron did before, right after the game where he's saying Kobe, he was just talking about Kobe, you know, I broke his record, but that's my man. I love him, grew up idolizing him. And not 12 hours later, you know, here Kobe texts him, you know, Kobe had said, way to carry the baton, he tweeted. Then he said, you know, 12 hours later, LeBron spoke to him a couple times in the morning even, obviously before Kobe left to get on the helicopter. And so it's almost movie-like, right? That the guy whose record he breaks, and the guy says, "Carry it on." One of the last tweets he sends is, "Carry on, carry forward the game." And the next day, this guy dies to become a legend at a young age, because you know when people die young before their time, they're immortalized, right? You're always going to see a young image of Kobe. You're never going to see an old picture of Kobe because we'll never see him.
Right.
He never get a chance to be old. And if you guys know, see one of the interviews that Tracy McGrady gave. He said that when they were younger, Kobe would say that to him, "I want to die young so I could be a legend."
Right.
You know, and obviously you have kids. He probably rethought that, you know, once he saw how his daughter and all of his daughters were growing. You know, he was he liked being a family guy. And, you know, you asked the question, what if? Because if you've seen any clips of Gigi playing, and I heard about Kobe's daughter because I'm a YouTube head and Facebook, and somebody had put a clip of her playing, talking about Kobe Bryant's daughter is a beast. And I clicked on, and you could see she had it. That's why UConn, she was already committed to go to UConn because, you know, you ask a question, what if? And they were going to call her Mambacita. You know, but what if? Because you got, if anybody gets a chance to look at some clips of Gigi Bryant, check her out on YouTube because she was getting ready to show all of the skills that her dad was bringing her up to do, and she was nice. So, you know, may he rest in peace, like I said.
That's the part, guys, that I think when you look at try to answer the question, why now? You see, certain things happen for a specific reason beyond our comprehension. And the fact that it superseded as egomaniacal individual where all the attention was his. You know, this president wants all this attention, and an African-American man superseded it in the blink of an eye. And it's sad that we lost our icon.
Right.
All things have purpose. All incidents have purpose. And at the point at which we get too lost in a virtual world set up of lies and theft and just perversion, we got to come back to reality. And this shook us. This moment, like the loss of Martin Luther King, the loss of Malcolm X, the loss of JFK, the loss of Bobby Kennedy, the loss.
You mean in terms of the collective feeling?
Yes.
Well, because we're kind
of
mixing your metaphors there when you're putting those guys. Kobe went with those guys, but you mean in terms of the collective effect of society?
Right. The effect on a world looking for truth. And it came at a moment when truth was put up in our face and a reality of, even on the night of the Grammys, it stopped them.
Right, yeah.
It stopped them. Now, who does that, Eric? Who does that, Wayne? That is beyond and above a kind of human experience, because you just said if they had to write the script, come on, guys. Who writes scripts like this?
Yeah. Only our creator, I tell you.
And Kobe, being the multilingual individual that he was, helped to elevate the basketball around the world. Mike put it out there around the world, and when Yao Ming came to the league, he put it around the world too. But Kobe, being a multilingual dude, that he could do it. You ever see that commercial he did where he's speaking Italian, playing basketball with his friend?
Yeah.
Back it was an old commercial, but here's Kobe speaking Italian, and they said he spoke Spanish too, obviously. You know, and he was, and someone said he had learned he was learning another language, Mandarin or whatever. He was focusing on Mandarin.
Right.
So,
to cut you off again. I mean, it's something about young men, because if I'm not mistaken, he didn't have a formal education until he came back to the States here, and then he just left high school and went directly into the NBA at 18. But
well, he graduated
was like
high
self-taught.
You know,
it was like that. I've worked with some people, you know, they weren't degreed. I mean, they dropped out of high school. And when, you know, and all of a sudden you rub shoulders with them in the same profession. And they're like light years ahead of you. I don't know if either one of you've experienced that with, you know, just coming
across
that in your
professional
lives.
Because they didn't waste that time learning stuff they didn't want to learn. You know, they didn't waste the time. You know, when you have people that know exactly what they want to do, the general liberal arts education, all the other stuff that they try to teach you, they say you have to get this, and this to get the degree.
Exactly.
I'm just trying to get a job over here as an actor. Why do I need to know physics? Or I'm trying,
I'm trying
to be a broadcast. I'm trying to go into media. I'm trying to do this.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's, I think, you know, where vocational schools have gone now. You know, your high school now, it's a normal thing for us to have a lot of tech schools, vocational tech schools, that are training people to do physical hands-on jobs, real-world experiences. Because if you remember, when we were, well, certainly when I was a kid, I'm sure when you guys were a kid, the tech school, a vocational school, meant that those were the hard cases. Those were the cats that couldn't.
Right, exactly.
At least this was the image in my mind. Those were the cats that couldn't sit down, couldn't be in class. So they go to tech school and learn how to be a mechanic. So,
and they were making better money than the rest of us.
You know what I'm saying? And I'm just getting ready to say that. And we all thought that was a bad thing. And turn around, you grow up and you're paying them. So, you know, that's the crazy part about it. Let me just say this. You know, there's one place where I think all people are in agreement, and if we could harness that power, I've thought about this before, that every person is in agreement, everybody's praying the same thing, and that's the ICU. And I've been in ICU way too many times in the last couple of years. And the one thing, everybody's on one accord, the patient and their family is saying, please, God, please, let this person get better. Patient is obviously, if they're able to pray, let me get better. Your family members, you're praying, please, God, let me get better. The staff, the medical people are working to make those people better. Everybody's on one accord in the ICU. We're all equal then. We all love our loved ones. We all want, and I'm not saying that to be funny at all. We all love our loved ones. We all want them to come through it. The medical staff wants the best outcome possible. And if we could just harness that power, remember what that feeling is, that we could all come together on that same in one accord, that we all have that one positive thing going in one direction. And I think, and I've often thought that, you know, after my experiences being that's the one thing. You're going and everybody's praying, God, please, let me just have that. And everybody's under one accord. And if we could just walk out of that place and remember that feeling, I hope that nobody has that feeling. But if you do, remember that we're all human at the end of the day. We all want the same thing. We all want to be with our loved ones. We We all want them to live as long as possible, or if they have to go, to go peacefully, quietly,
mm-hmm.
when they're ready. And the medical staff is trying to give us that. So we really need to remember and try to work, and it makes you realize the true evil there is in the world that chooses and tries to upset that, tries to disrupt that. And we're seeing that now, like you guys said. And it's and Byron, you were talking about how I'm paraphrasing you, how ironic that Kobe upstage Trump, who wants to suck up all the air, everybody's air. But isn't it even more ironic that in the beginning of Trump's or in the beginning of his attempts to get into politics, that he was overshadowed by an African-American man, and that this very time, which might be the end, he's overshadowed again by an African-American man? It must really get to him deep down inside.
Please.
You know?
Hashtag Black Lives Matter.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You know, and as we watch this trial and watch his people lie, you know, I mean, if you guys have been watching as I've been watching today, and you saw a couple of lawyers lie, and then the matter just get up and said no, when the guy tried to say they never subpoenaed John Bolton. They never subpoenaed him. Schiff gets up. Somebody has to just subpoena. Yes, we did. As a matter of fact, we subpoenaed blah, blah, blah. So it's like, wow, these guys, and obviously it reiterated itself to me that lawyers, they lie. Well, one of Shakespeare's lines, Byron. Kill all the lawyers.
Absolutely.
What was that line? So, you know, it's that gray, you know, wiggle room area that the law allows. But also, you know, if you get the wrong individuals, I guess that's why you have to allow a child molester like Jeffrey Epstein the right to get fair representation, even though you know he's despicable and did the things he do. So that's your job as a lawyer, right? That you take that oath. But you don't have to take the case.
Yeah.
You don't have to take the case of a despicable individual like that. So what does that say about you as a lawyer when you take that case, Mr. Dersher, douchebag?
Well,
you know
there are ambulance chases all over the damn place. You know?
I mean, and here's this guy's going to stand up here in the well of the Senate and try to present himself like he has any type of credibility when he's the one who worked out the deal in Florida for Epstein to get out of jail and go about his daily work while he was doing the same thing, taking these girls to his own private island and putting them through whatever type of horrors they had to go through. And this despicable bastard is going to stand there in the well and talk about when it's proof that 20 years ago he said the same exact thing, and this guy is supposed to get some sort of reverence because he's Alan Dershowitz. He's nothing but a despicable individual in my estimation. Go ahead.
And that whole professorial presentation the other day, it just blew me away the way he just kept running stuff. And if you sat there and didn't understand or comprehend what he was saying, basically, a lot of it just did not make any sense at all. You know, no one is above the law. You know, and
but that's
just
what they do. They have
things.
Nothing. You know, they're telling
Trump
that joke. They have nothing. Right.
Yeah. And I'm ashamed because
right?
20 years ago, I used to call on him all the time to talk about the OJ thing. But, you know, he knows. I guess he doesn't want. He's like the Teflon Don. He doesn't want to stick to any one thing. You know, he'll do things that are politically and more importantly, I think he'll do things that are financially expedient to him. It's not even politics.
Of course.
I don't even think he, you know, it's about making money. He's 81 years old now, and he's got a contract with Fox. And because of his background in the past, I think he capitalized on the idea that, well, I'm older now, I'm doing whatever the hell I want to do or say whatever I want to say, and it makes no sense. You know, same damn thing with Giuliani, you know.
Oh,
not
yeah,
to say that
I mean,
had much faith with him at all.
And also Ken Starr. So, I mean, you know, these guys get up there and they pontificate. And let me tell you something, I don't even have a law degree. I bet you I could argue them guys down. I'm looking at them like, that's all you got? And I like to argue. So, you know, I'll eat them up. You know,
and
it's just unbelievable.
And I know Byron would
stand.
Be good at that because he could go back and say, well, you know, on such and such date,
Absolutely.
I tell you.
That's what Dershowitz was doing, going back to the 1800s or whatever. If you saw him on The View this morning, Whipple was like, whoa, 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 man, we're not trying to go back all that far. But that's what they do. It's a filibuster, right? You just talk in circles. And that's what they're doing here, talk in circles. And they said that the lawyers have a saying, if you have what, do you have the truth, you could bang the table. If you don't have anything, bang the table. Or if you're wrong, bang the table.
Yeah,
you have nothing.
Right.
Whatever, you know, argue the system or whatever. But that's what these guys do. And that's what I'm talking about, the legal profession. You know, how many times have you got people have had to go to court? And it's a simple thing. You can answer the judge. You can say, but you can't because the other person has a lawyer or there's a prosecutor there or whatever, and you're not speaking, you're not posing the question in the right language, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though you could clearly answer what they said, but maybe you didn't pose it, the sentence the right way.
And you
understand to a certain degree why it has to be that way because, you know, in a conversation you get individuals who go off on tangents and things like that and they say things that aren't germane to the subject matter and stuff like that. But there's also that whole little thing is like they got like a little cottage industry, you know. It's like the court of law, to come in here and to be able to speak, you need to hire a lawyer or else we're really not going to recognize you. And the lawyer is because he has gone through law school. He understands the language that we speak in, the language of law, allegedly, that we speak. But within that, it's like their own club. So they make their own cottage industry in their own club, and they have their own little language. And once they understand the way to manipulate that language, much like parliamentary rules of procedure. They understand how to manipulate the language and the procedures. So therefore, they can talk in circles for years, and you can never get anything done if they want. That's why there's 300 bills sitting in front of Mitch McConnell's office waiting to be signed. And these idiots are going to stand up there and say, well, if you have a trial, then nothing will get done in the Senate. Nothing's getting done anyway because your boy Mitch is not letting these bills come up for debate in the Senate. But they rely on people not knowing how the process works.
Do you think they'll actually get to a point where they'll have witnesses?
Well, you know, the thing that – I was just going to say that an anecdotal story for you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm on my way home from my walk this afternoon, and I run into someone who's out in the front raking their yard for the leaves. It's about 5 o'clock. He says he's a teacher, middle school, white, male. And he says it's been a rough day today. And so he says, when he says it's been a rough day today, I said, well, don't worry, it's going to get better. And we have to keep truth alive and you keep moving ahead. And then he kind of swayed into the political arena, as that is the conversation in a lot of that goes on in D.C. And I said, well, you know, I said, keep hope alive. Keep your faith alive. And the last thing I said to him, I said, keep the Constitution alive, because that's what this is all about.
Right.
We can't allow the despair of what's going on take us into the rabbit hole where these men and women want to get us into a vortex of confusion and chaos.
Mm-hmm.
We must avoid those pitfalls. Because ultimately what is at stake is not just a presidency, but an entire nation of 246 years. Can it sustain this impunity, you know, that's implying that you can be above the law? It's going to be questioning itself. It's about the rule of the law. It is about the pureness of the law. And you can pervert it all along the way. It has been for a long time. But you strip away the perversions, and you still got to come back to, is it wrong to kill, cheat, steal, lie? Those things are the things that justice is supposed to prevail. And if they cannot prevail in those arenas, don't even worry about the nation, because the nation's dead. It is dead philosophically. It is dead morally.
Mm.
Those are the challenges.
Yeah. Go ahead, Wayne.
No, I was just going to say, as an aside, you mentioned the nation being dead morally and philosophically. I was watching a little bit of local news, and of course Trump had his big moment in Wildwood State Park last night at the convention center down there in South Jersey. And I don't know if you saw the volume of filth his supporters left behind in the streets of that city. This little summer beach town that, you know, only a handful of us get to go to from time to time. I just said this, just looking at the mess that they left behind is reflective of the mentality of his supporters. You know.
Right.
I don't know if you had a chance to see it, but it was just one of those things.
I did not see how much they left, but I know that there does not seem to be a very kind of a consideration for other people and a lot of Trump supporters, particularly other people that don't look like they look. And,
right.
You know,
exactly.
It's an interesting thing that you said about the law, you know, the Constitution and all that, and they can, you know, and we see how they bastardized the law and all this stuff, but. And the technicalities that they rely on to nullify things and such, but really, you brought up the main point, Wayne. It's moral. There's a morality here. Our laws are based on moral laws, right? Loosely based on the Ten Commandments, allegedly. So is it morally right for this man to threaten people, to threaten this woman, to make her feel like her life is in danger? I'm talking about the ambassador who he said is going to go through some things. Is it morally right for this man to talk about the dead in such a despicable manner, that, like he did with John McCain, a war hero, and denigrated his service? Not only talked about him at that time before he died, but then when he was dead again, talked about him again, disrespected? Is that morally right? So these people have no leg to stand on because they claim to be religious. Evangelical Christians, which to me is another code word or for the demographics of white racist Christians, because if you follow Franklin Graham and these other people, they seem to go with the status quo of you know, racism, prejudice, and everything else, and bowing down to the rich. So you know, when we talk about America and the Constitution, I'm always, like I told you before, I'm always kind of side-eye-ish with it, because when we talk about America being great, yeah, America has been great because there's people who've chosen to make it great and ever evolving to make it live up to its promise. But we know that the public face of America hasn't always been what America has actually been about. And there are people in our country that are above the law, right? We all... They're rich people, and usually they're very rich, very powerful, very connected. And Trump knows that. And the whole thing about what he's doing, he's revealing all of their playbooks, right? Because the Republicans now are doing the same thing that they did with George Bush. When George Bush and, you know, the whole 9/11 and Iran going to war in Iraq and all that stuff, when they made up the lie about that. And then Vice President Dick Cheney tried to out Valerie Plame in hopes that she would get killed, because that's the only reason you would do that to one of your clandestine agents. You're hoping that something happens to them, much like Trump hopes that something happens to these people when he tweets and says all these negative things. He's hoping that one of these people that are too swift in the brain or take things a little bit too literal take matters into their own hand and do something. That's the only reason that you would do that, because you know the power of your words, right? So why would you do that unless you're trying to get people killed? And clearly, when you say both people, it stops when we all have to stand up, I would suppose. But the thing about the history of America, and I'm sure Byron could speak to this better than I could, there's a lot of nuances to that, because there's a lot of people that act like they're on the right side when they're really just the devil's advocate, you know. And I went to see Hamilton over the last Friday, thanks to my sister Christy. It was a birthday present to my sister Lisa, and so we all went. And the only thing I remember learning about Alexander Hamilton was that he was a vice president. Him and Aaron Burr got it on, and he came out the short end of the duel. I had no idea of his background, that he might have been a person of mixed racial heritage.
Yeah, right.
So
They do go into that in the play, right?
That's what the play. That's the whole reason.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Because I didn't see it.
I mean, that's why there's that's why they have black and brown people playing these roles, right?
Gotcha.
So you got to wonder when they say he was the guy who he was the one responsible for the Constitution and everything, and in the Constitution, black people are considered 1/8 blood black, or you're human or whatever. Do you think that it makes sense now that I think about it? Was Alexander Hamilton trying to advocate a little bit for his heritage? You know, was he trying to say, well, okay, you got to treat the slaves. Maybe was he at the meeting and said, well, come on, you got to at least make them half a human. They're like, hell no, no, we're not going to make them half a human. Okay, a quarter human. No, no, Alexander, you're crazy. No, they're dark. They're beneath. Okay, 1/8 of a human. Come on, guys. 1/8 of a human. Okay, maybe. You know? So,
hey, man.
And otherwise, why did they do that? Oh, Byron, you know why, because you had the answer to that before the Electoral College. But
right.
my question is, where did that notion even come up? I mean, and now that I see this with Alexander Hamilton, maybe, I don't know. It caused me to think along those lines. So why don't you address that, Mr. Historian?
It did come up in the manner for which you are asking. It has been brushed under the carpet in terms of the story itself, just like the information regarding Sally Hemings and Jefferson.
Yeah.
You see, these are stories, that's right, but these are stories that have been pushed aside to create a narrative that would be very supportive of the lie. Sound kind of familiar?
Yeah, kind of like those savage Indians who wanted to kill everybody because they were just bloodthirsty. Yeah, kind of like that lie, right?
Kind of like that lie. And so if you keep compounding that lie, then you come up with a story that even if you go to the Hamilton house up in New York, they'll tell you the story of his parentage, of his relationship to the islands as a heritage within his bloodline that, yes, was from one of those slaves.
I think from St. Kitts or one of the
Kitts,
if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
so
what we have to
really be conscious of, once again, is the truth. Because truth is what's on trial here.
Exactly.
And see, and we kind of fail to understand and comprehend the value of truth. It's not $399,000, $1 million worth of security and weaponry sold to a nation. It's the truth on how it got there. Why are we handling and using diplomacy when all that we are doing are being arms merchants? We're not perpetuating peace. We're perpetuating confrontation, and that comes back to bite you every single time because it has no value in peace other than death. Pure and simple.
Well,
Dr. King said an eye for an eye means, right? In his statement, an eye for an eye leaves both men blind.
Blind, toothless, and probably end up dead. And that's why even the Prince of Peace said, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. We have yet, gentlemen, think of this. 246 years this country has been alive. 244 years of those 246 years have been in confrontation every single one of those years.
When you say 246 years, hold on, let me stop you for a minute. You say 246.
That's right. The United States of America is 246 years old. 244 of those years, we've been in wars and confrontation. What do we know about
people? I got a question. Hold on for a minute. Let me slow you down. So, Tudor, you said as United States has been in existence for 246 years, except we've been in bondage for 400. So how does square that for me? You mean the actual formation of the United States as a country has been?
The formation of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, and minus 2020, and what do you get? You come up with a figure of how many years this country has been in its existence. in each of one of those 240-some years, 242 years of it, we have been in a war confrontation each one of those 247 years. So the question must seriously be asked, what do we know about peace if it's not wrapped up in a confrontation, a war, a civil war, a Vietnam, every 240-some years of our existence, we've been in wars.
Yeah.
So here you have a trial about a president who is withholding money to buy weapons for another war with which Americans are engaged in. The sordidness of this entire episode is about arms dealing, is about war, is about death.
It's also about his willingness to use that to his advantage against his political opponents. It's also about that. So we can't forget that is also part of that truth as well. And I think even more than it, war has always been America's business. So we know that.
Right.
Donald Trump's business has been Donald Trump. And if war is a part of that, can be a subsidiary of his Trump business, then yeah, he's good for it.
Who profits? Who profits from the wars? Who profits from the wars? The last profit from the last war, the big one that we had, was Blackwater. What was the operation? The company.
Oh, the one that Dick Cheney.
Halliburton.
His company profited.
Halliburton,
KBR,
or something like that.
Right.
So it's all about the money. It's never been about democracy. It's never been about human conditions. It's always been about war.
But one thing, Byron, I understand, and I applaud what you're saying. I embrace it and all that. But if you've lived in the third world or in places where there are dictatorships and there isn't, a balance, it sort of puts America in a completely different, realm, because there is a fighting chance for democracy here.
Right.
Every once in a while, this government has to be slapped in the face, and something sobering has to happen, like the death of Kobe Bryant, or something just to right the wrong, to set the axis back where it should be. But if you've lived in the Caribbean, not just so much the Caribbean, but South America, Africa, different places where they're just rulers, and you have to go according to what the ruler wants,
right.
There is no balance. And I'm not saying this is great here, because I identify, not many of my West Indian brothers and sisters will go along with this, but I understand the black struggle in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I see what it's done for us. I also see the opportunities that we have before us, But the bottom line is that, we got to get rid of people like Orange Man just to straighten out and bring things back to how they should be, to basically get the boat on course and afloat before it just sinks like the Titanic. And that's what I worry about, because he gets away with this. It's like what Schiff said, anyone else going forward will use this as an example to say, well, it was cool for him to do it, And
right.
And I tell you, the whole Bill Clinton thing, they keep going back to that, but that pales in comparison, man.
It's no comparison. He didn't do it.
It's a family matter,
Yeah, he didn't do it to he wasn't trying to win an election. He wasn't doing it to try to get.
Right.
He was trying to save his marriage, trying to save his ass
once again.
Well, I think if you ask yourself.
Breaking it down. Break it all the way down, Wayne.
I think if you ask yourself the question. Back up like about 5 months ago, and you asked the question back then, is impeachment and a trial necessary? The answer is, in order to fix the problem, you just can't fix it from where you picked up that there was a problem. You got to go back to its origins. You got to go back to the Constitution. You have to go back to the moment that's happening right now in order to show, even historically, whether it goes yay or nay for acquittal or conviction, is that this system had to go through this process in order to get its compass back on track.
Right.
Because what happens beyond the acquittal, what happens between now and the election, is going to be a revelation of truth sweeping the country, because everyone who either voted for or against is going to be scrutinized like they have never been scrutinized before. They will be vetted. You will not be able to walk down the street. That's what's going to happen. It's happening optically right now as we speak. People are seeing how government really works, whether they want to see it or not. It's
or not,
in their
exactly.
face.
Right. You know. I mean, that's why that's a very good point. Democracy is very delicate, right? And B, whether they want to see it or not, because that's what they're arguing right now as we speak, right? Whether or not to have witnesses, because then they can continue to bury their head in the sand if they act like they don't see it, just like they used to act like they didn't want to have, you know, before we had the Negro Leagues of Baseball, and they didn't want to act like they saw Satchel Paige pitching and striking everybody out and breaking all records or whoever. And then they said, come on in, we'll let you all come in. But they want to act like they didn't see it, just like they wanted to act like Hank Aaron wasn't going to break Babe Ruth's record and all that other stuff. So, I mean, you know, they'll act like they don't see it, just like they act like they didn't see in the Bible where it said, the part where it said Jesus had that kind of color to his skin. But, you know, people try to make it work however they try to make it work. You know?
Well,
I mean,
well,
that's the truth. We're talking about the truth,
right?
And
it's important to realize that even today, guys, because today is such an important day, and we haven't heard a mumbling word from any of the media outlets, including our own. But today is the 200th birthday of Harriet Tubman.
Oh,
wow.
Today is the birthday of Harriet Tubman.
Well, and the movie company that put out a movie, we might want to do an extra push today, but obviously not.
Exactly. And we are letting the optics of all this other stuff take it away from our moment. We celebrate a woman, another African-American, who stopped the world in its tracks.
Well, I tell you, Byron, in all honesty, man, you know, I still go back to this whole dichotomy shift with media, you know? I mean, if there were more places for us to even put this show on, thank God it's out there in the ether with the rest of the other podcasts, you know? People know where to go. They go to Blog Talk Radio to get this. You know, there are other places, other venues where people have... You know, but it's not the same. It's not like how it was before social media, you know, came forward. And unfortunately, some of us who have the means in which to put a station back on a national basis, they're not looking that way. You know, it's like it saddens me. But, you know, I'm moving with the times. You know, we have to adjust to what goes on. But and maybe... Maybe it was overlooked because of the Kobe Bryant thing, but still, you're absolutely
right. Well,
you know,
I look at it like this. We are part of the Underground Railroad Express. We are the new Underground Railroad where you go to get food, you go to get values, you go to get a focus on the real world and not the virtual world.
Right.
There it is. You get the last word, Byron. We are the drum. We got 56 seconds, so give the people your sign off, Brother Byron. That was very eloquent, but tell them goodbye.
Peace and love always. And remember, you have the power to make change happen because you have the vote. Use it. Stop acting like a minority. Start acting like the majority.
Gotcha. There it is from the historian. See you next week. Bye. Gotta go. Thank you, my brother. All right. Legendary newsman, Mr. Wayne Gilman.
I don't know how to stop Byron, but I'm just keeping hope alive, brother. That's all I got to say.
There it is. Very, very Jesse Jackson of you, Wayne. All right, my brother. I will talk to you soon. Talk to you again next week. This has been the Kay Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. I am the one that's called the Sun, Citizen Payne, and my mom is on assignment in heaven. We love you. Join us again next week. We'll try to be live for you, but if you know, we're always archived. Kay Thompson Live, Blog Talk Radio. See you again next week.